Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight where Blanche Delbrugge makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's been here on a couple of times before. She's a well-known writer of fiction and non-fiction, and her books include Mediator, a biography of Sir Richard Kirby, Monkeys in the Dark, Turtle Beach, Robert J. Hawke, a biography, Winter in Jerusalem, White Eye, among other works. And today, Blanche Delbrugge is in conversation with Anne Henderson around the time of the publication of her recent book, The Young Lion, which is here. And Anne, our Deputy Director, is going to talk to Blanche about the book for about half an hour or thereabouts, and then we'll have questions and discussion from the floor. Anne, Blanche, lead off. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm to lead off.
I will lead you off. Look, Blanche, thank you for coming and giving us this chance to talk to you about the book. It's a terrific book, everybody, and it's only the first of three.
Four. Quartet.
I thought it was a trilogy. That's even better.
That's even better.
And what's wonderful about the book is not only is it full of intricate details that make you feel that you belong in the world that you're reading about, but it's made it accessible to a modern reader at the same time. So it's very historical, but it's very accessible. But what I want to know is why the Plantagenets? We've had films and all sorts of things on the Plantagenets. So tell us what took you there.
Well, it's really one Plantagenet, and that is Henry II, the first of the Plantagenets. It goes back to when my 20s, when I was very interested in the 12th century, because at that time it was extraordinarily fashionable to say, if you disagreed with anybody, oh, one of the great minds of the 12th century. And I used to say it myself. And one day, and that would be, of course, anybody over the age of 30, that you'd be, would be a great mind of the 12th century. And one day I thought, I know nothing at all about the 12th century. So I went out and bought a book and I started to read. And over the years, I bought more, wherever I was, I'd look out for little books on costumes, on weaponry, on pharmacology, pharmacopoeias, on the bestiaries and those sort of things. So I had this great deal of knowledge about that time, and of course the fact that that was the time of the great building of the Gothic cathedrals and so forth. But I was talking one day to somebody who drew my attention to Henry II as the founder of the concept of the rule of law. And that was something very close to my heart, having lived in a number of countries without the rule of law. And reading the newspapers and seeing what a disaster it is that it's really only in the democracies that the rule of law operates. So I became interested in Henry, started reading about Henry. And if I may, I'll just quickly go through his biography. At the age of 14, he invaded England completely unsuccessfully and went home, was home in disgrace. By the age of 16, he had been through the ordeal to become a royal knight, which is a sort of a mystery journey imposed on him by his uncle, David, King of Scotland. By 18, he was Duke of Normandy. By 19, he had managed to marry Eleanor of Aquitaine, the richest and most beautiful woman in Europe, and former Queen of France, divorced wife of Louis. And by 21, he was crowned King of England. by 25, he had established what became known thereafter as the Angevin Empire, because he was actually born not in Normandy but in Anjou. And it was an empire that stretched from the north of Scotland to the Pyrenees and from Ireland to the Mediterranean. So he was the most powerful king in Europe at the age of 25, so a really considerable human being, and he introduced the rule of law.
When you, in your acknowledgements at the end, you say that the story of Henry is differently recorded with the French. The French have different sorts of takes on it, which you'd expect. Tell me about that. How did it change your view of some of the history of England in terms of Henry? And what was their difference?
It didn't change my view of the history of England, nor did it particularly change my view of Henry, Henry's personality. But the French fully expected that he would become King of France. And indeed, had he not made that extremely unfortunate mistake with Thomas Becket, he probably could have become King of France. But the murder of Becket, for which I've got no doubt that Henry was responsible, ruled him out. There was such revulsion against it throughout Europe. The Pope was so furious that he refused to speak to any Englishman for a whole week. He got over it.
Didn't have mobiles then. That's another issue that is in your book, and very much in the characters as much as the institutions, the role of the church. We've all forgotten about the role of the church in terms of its political force as well as its moral force, and kings were quite intimidated by their notion of moral behaviour, even though they were always doing naughty and terrible things, murder and lust and whatever, but they did have this notion that the will of God and the Pope's law was important. Can you tell us a bit more about how that involves itself with Henry?
Henry personally was not a great he was not a great genuflector before the church. It's hard to say even that he was a genuine believer, although he used to have to lead his people into chapel every morning. But the importance of the church that you've mentioned there was another strand to it. And it was socially enormously important because it was, of course, we're dealing with a feudal society, so everybody has their place and it's all completely clear and worked out. You have duties and responsibilities to this person, and he has duties and responsibilities to you. The one way out of a lowly birth was through the church. It, for intelligent boys and girls, it was the ladder from a life as a labourer or a washerwoman into the, it could be even into the upper echelons of society. If you're intelligent enough and you became an abbess, for example, you would be going to court and dealing with the royals. And similarly, you become a bishop and a baron.
Yes, the bishops, of course, were very worldly. They were just like another part of the aristocracy. Now, to what extent did some of those illegitimate children of kings or queens or the royal households find their way through the church? I noticed that his first son, illegitimate son,
Geoffrey,
became
Bishop of Lincoln.
Right.
Yes.
Did the church get used in that way to give them some sort of status without any kind of notion of their inheritance?
In fact, it was illegal, officially illegal, for a bastard to become a bishop.
Okay.
In Geoffrey's case was very interesting because Richard Coeur de Lion, he would have never called himself Lionheart because he never learned to speak English. He was a terrible man, in my view. Was very anxious lest Geoffrey, who was older than he and illegitimate, would seize the throne, and he forced Geoffrey into the church.
I see. Makes sense. Right, let's look at the women. Yeah. there's this wonderful young woman called, is it Zena?
Zena.
And I
went... just meant foreigner in Greek.
Yes. And I want you to tell us a little bit about it, because she's a slave girl who gets brought to France by Eleanor after her journey on the Crusades, and she rescues her or buys her from her slavery. She's also of Jewish background. But when I went looking for the origins of a particular kind of Zena, whether it was the mother of the illegitimate Geoffrey, whatever, I could find a name that was obviously Middle Eastern of some kind, or certainly exotic, that might have been the woman who gave birth to this illegitimate firstborn of Henry. But what I'm interested in is, where did you find her? Was it from this sort of sliver of information? Right. But is there any basis in historical fact for this woman, in the sense of being out there? There was one mention that this mother of the firstborn illegitimate could be a prostitute.
Yes, I think I think when historians have got no idea who was the mother of him, they say it was a prostitute.
It's a generic.
Yes, that's right. Well, Geoffrey had a mother. He didn't come out of an egg. So that is the case with a great deal of history. I think it's changing now, but with the histories written up until almost up until this period, but certainly the greatest book on Henry was written in the 1970s. And those traditional academic historians would often just give you a name and no bones, no flesh on the bones whatsoever. It was just so-and-so did this, did that, did something else, because there was nothing in the record to substantiate and to turn this into a human being. But as a novelist, I had to turn all of these names into humans and give them believable characteristics. So that's where the Zena comes from.
So the lovely story, the romance, is all in Blanche's imagination.
Because he absolutely adored that son. With him, holding his hand when he died.
Yes, and she's conveniently there. Well, Queen Eleanor, tell us about what you believe about Queen Eleanor. I mean, she's caught by her gender, but she's the most powerful woman imaginable as well. We haven't got to the locked up bit.
No. Henry had a very powerful mother who was Matilda. She was the Empress of Germany. She was the only surviving legitimate child of Henry I, the Lion. And three times Henry I got his nobles to swear that they would accept her as king of England. And breaking an oath in those days was a very serious matter. It was considered, it wasn't just bad form, considered criminal. And so three times they swore they would have Matilda, but when the moment came, a cousin slipped in, went to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he said, "We can't possibly have a woman ruling us. This is against the laws of God and man. It's completely unnatural." And the Archbishop said, "You're quite right, my dear," and anointed him King Stephen. One of the things I find very interesting is that ever since, and that's over 900 years, there's never been another Stephen. The royals don't forget. you usurp the throne.
That's interesting.
Never been another. His crown prince was Eustace. There's never been another prince called Eustace.
Yes. And we have the George again. In the little last one.
Yes. But so Henry's mother was extraordinarily powerful and very disgruntled. She'd been robbed of a throne. And she brought Henry up from birth to know that he must avenge this injustice and take the kingdom. And so she trained him to be a king very successfully.
Yes.
He had the problem of money. Eleanor was born the Duke of Normandy. The Duke of Aquitaine, because she was the only she was the elder child of the Duke. There were only two, her and a sister, And so she was brought up as a more or less as a man to rule Aquitaine. It was a very rebellious province. And at the age of 14, she was forced into marriage with the son of the King of France, who was 17, who didn't want to be a king. He wanted to be a monk. And he had no interest in sex. She was 14, he was 17 and a virgin. It was a complete disaster. A very unhappy marriage from the word go. They managed to have only two children, both daughters, and it was considered a queen's duty to provide an heir for the throne. Eleanor really wanted to get rid of Louis and did everything she could, and she was quite insulting to him a lot of the time. She petitioned the Pope for a divorce on the grounds of consanguinity. The church in those days forbade the marriage of people related within 7 degrees of cousinhood. Of course, this was more honoured in the breach than in the fact. And she was denied a divorce for many years, but finally her adulteries, which feminists say, oh, this is a terrible thing to say to her, you know, she was such a wonderful woman. Well, she might have been. She was a wonderful woman.
Just doing
woman.
What any other queen, king would do.
Yes, that's right. But so finally she did get...
She got
the divorce, but she was a wonderful politician. She got the divorce and she kept all the money. Which was... took a great deal of diplomatic skill. And Louis showed what a poor judge of certainly his ex-wife he was, and generally how naive he still was, by not keeping his eye on what she did next, which was, as his richest vassal, to marry his most puissant, his most powerful vassal. That was the young Duke of Normandy. And once Henry had married Eleanor, he had the brawn and she had the brass. And England was next.
So tell us about Henry. I mean, Henry is, you're showing light in a sense, he's an outstanding figure of kingship. Tell us a bit about kingship, the qualities required. He does wrest it from someone else, but he's obviously able to conquer and hold. And is there still some lessons in that old notion of kingship for leaders today?
Yes, he was a very considerable warlord. Number one, a king had to be able to lead his army into battle, and Henry was a very good fighter and a very successful one. And he was also a cautious one. He knew the exigencies of war. He knew not to go rushing into battle because it could go against you, although it was looking very good. So he had that natural leadership quality. He had he's what you'd call an alpha male, I think.
I think so.
He was humorous, good humoured and jovial, but he had an absolutely frightful, terrifying temper, which got worse as he got older. And he was he came under more and more strain. And of course his personal life from the very beginning, because people in those days marriage among the aristocracy was much more like mergers and acquisitions, as it still is today for some people, really. I say if anybody who marries for money earns every penny. it was a very dysfunctional family, and in due course that would rip the empire apart. But Eleanor herself was a woman of considerable learning. She was a formidable character. She was very beautiful. She was very rich. She was very self-confident. And she was very artistic. She had an artistic nature. She was a great patron of the arts. She was a fashionista. She invented a number of fashions, including a lovely little thing called the barrette with the headdress, with the thing under your chin like this, and slashing your sleeves so that the silk of a different colour on the inside would show. She was famous for her banquets, for the amusement she would put on banquets. I think all of us as children heard that, knew that song, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie. Well, that was Eleanor's pie. One of her chefs invented that. So she had that kind of sophistication. She was très soignée. She was really something else.
Well, just to finish on, we
could talk that long.
No, we leave others to ask some questions. I just want to get you to give us your view of how critics review or think of romantic fiction, because reading this book, it's hugely informative as well as hugely entertaining. And the work you've done in the research, the minutiae of people's lives, some of which you've mentioned now, all of this is not fictional. It's real life. You've brought the 12th century to our, you know, our imagination. So where does romantic fiction fit? Because it's not really all fiction, and should it be regarded a little bit more highly at times by the Academy?
Well, I must say, I'm somebody who never reads reviews. Good, bad or indifferent, I don't give a stuff, if I can use that expression. So, what the Academy says or doesn't say, I don't know. It's of no concern to me.
Okay.
I reckon it's my problem. I write with my heart's blood. They write for money.
I'm thinking the ones that don't write for money. Anyway, it's a fantastic story, a fantastic study, and a fantastic experience. And I guess Jared's going to take over now and get you to ask Blanche some questions.
Yeah, many thanks to Blanche and to Anne for the questions. Blanche Dauphiné and Nicholson. I think you're not contributing to this, or maybe
I don't need to.
No, I just should do a couple of things. Thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this facility. We have some copies of The Young Lion. It's quite a unique book, as Anne has pointed out. It's a trilogy in four parts. It's quite a good price, $29.99, but at the Sydney Institute you can get it for this special Sydney Institute price of $30, which is incentive to be here. So now we'll lead off with, and I'm sure Blanche will be happy to sign books after the talk. So we lead off anyone who's an expert on 12th century France can start first.
I'm interested, given, as you said, that the historical... I'm given interested, as you said, Blanche, that the historical record is quite flat, how you approach understanding the psyche of the characters and putting some flesh on the bones for a novel, because there's a responsibility there, isn't there, I imagine, as well, to try to be true to what you think the personality of the character may have been, particularly with the women, when there's so little detail in the historical record.
So just for the blog, how do you build on characters when there's not much evidence around of what they were like?
That's kind of a question about how do you write.
Yeah.
And what I do is go into my ivory tower, which is a very small, ugly flat in Cameray, with cold water and no telephone and no window. The window is so high, only my nose would get there. And they come and talk to me. And I think that's how, one way or another, that's the experience of all writers writing fiction. You turn up, and the muse will turn up for you.
Do you give them tea and coffee or anything?
No.
But you'd have to read a lot.
You don't start that process until you've done all the research. Though there are some occasions when you suddenly think, oh, I really have a gap there. I don't know that. In which case you have to ask them just to step back for a moment and do some more research, and then you can go on. But that is the process of the imagination in forming.
Question, Anna. You stand up if you're not in front of the camera, that's fine.
How much planning do you have to do when you say you're writing a quartet? How much do you have to say to book one, two, or three before you plan it all out from the start?
How much planning required in writing a quartet?
Yes. You have to know the entire life. And at first I thought I knew where I was going to make the breaks, but then I started adding in, well, I think enriching it so much with other characters that I realised that the breaks had to fall elsewhere. So the first book starts with him being born, well, it really starts with Eleanor coming back from the Crusades and her relationship with Henry's father, and ends with him being crowned king. And the next book starts with, it just backtracks a tiny bit and starts with running up to the coronation, those first years with Becket. The second book is basically the relationship with Becket and what's going wrong. The third book is the fight between the church and state, which Henry loses. It was a tragedy that he lost. There would have been no need for the Reformation. Seriously, it was on a small number of silly things on which he was overly dogmatic, and had those the reforms that he was asking for being brought in, then you wouldn't have had the horrors of Henry VIII. But and then the last book is the rebellion by his family, which leads to death.
So we go 1, 2, 3. Yeah.
Blanche, do you think medieval men or women think the same we would think in the 21st century?
Do medieval men and women think the same way as we would think today?
There are certain things in human nature that really don't change. I'm reading the Analects of Confucius at the moment, which are 2,500 years old. And you find a similarity there in a great thinker, cool thought, in thoughts about politics and so forth. But of course it was a feudal society, and we live in a democratic society, so that of itself gives a very different consciousness to things. Look at the difference between us and the Americans, for example. So yes, there are certain things of sexual attraction and love or hatred of children and parents, those things don't change, but many other things do. Ambition doesn't change much. Lucifer remains among us.
Could you tell us a bit more about your research methods, and did you actually go back to the 12th century materials? Did you find a blackbird recipe book?
I'm afraid I didn't find that book. Well, I did all my research in English initially, and then I worked with a couple of French historians, and they translated French books, because I can read and write French, but slowly. I didn't go to any of the Latin, which is what everything originally was written in. But I did go back to what is left of the palaces and convents and cathedrals. So I went back to the places, and when I was travelling in both France and England, always tried to stay as far as possible away from cities and in the simplest accommodation in the countryside. So to get an idea of what it was like to be without electricity at night. I've got time to tell a funny story.
Yeah.
We were over in Wales and got incredibly... Were you waving something?
None of you.
Oh, okay. Yes. We were over in Wales and we drove from where we were staying to a pub to get dinner and then had to drive back and there wasn't a light anywhere. There were these enormously high sort of vegetation walls between everything. We got hopelessly lost, and after about an hour driving around in the dark, we found we were back at where we started. And we went in, they all laughed. Oh, you're back again. I said, it's terribly dark out there. Yes, one of the men. Over here in Wales, we've got something called night.
Just before I go to the next question, I mean, what were the main landmarks you went to? What's the main of the surviving buildings and places?
Well, Chinon, where Henry died, of course, and... in France, sorry. Yes. That's a very, very important castle. And I always mispronounce it, where his and Eleanor's and Richard's are supposedly buried. They actually were buried there, but during the Revolution, of course, all the royals' graves were dug up and their bones were flung about. It was vandalism on a grand scale. And so the Gisard, it's called, the death masks of both Eleanor and Henry, and nobody knows what they look like.
And in England? Britain?
In Britain, well, he built Dover Castle, which, of course, withstood World War II, which was not a bad effort. I went to lots of cathedrals. I can't remember the names of all of them, but I've been to Windsor and in the past, but nothing's left of his hunting lodge at Woodstock. Blenheim Castle is there now.
Yes.
My question was actually going to be about that. You know, we're so far away here in Australia, and you know, do you take inspiration from those kind of geographical places? So you've answered that. So, but I just wanted to explore that a little more and maybe ask you, what was the most inspirational place that you went to around Eleanor?
The most inspirational place that you went to around Eleanor?
Oh, undoubtedly Poitiers.
So where is that in France?
In Poitou. So it's south, but
in
not.
I beg your pardon? In the Dordogne.
In the Dordogne.
I only know the 12th century now. I'm sorry. it's quite a big town. And she had a lovely palace there where she used to hold court. And it was just a very, very impressive place, and you got a great sense of this woman. She was an early Democrat in a way. She allowed a commune to be formed, which was really quite something in the 12th century. I must say something else about Eleanor. Everybody thinks that people in the 12th century were the size of hobbits and died at 40. They were not. Richard Coeur de Lion, for example, was 6'5", blonde and gay. Eleanor had 10 children and lived to the age of 81. Pope Pius III, in the cloister, it was much easier to live longer, lived till 93. So they weren't tiny little people all carking young. But of course, the men died from battles. They were having battles all the time. They died from wounds and infections, and women would die in childbirth. But if you were in the cloister, if you were a churchman, you had a good chance for living
and
eating well. That's the other thing. They had really important, because people have said to me, weren't they frightened of getting venereal diseases, having so much sex? There were no venereal diseases. Syphilis had existed some hundreds of years earlier and had completely died out, and of course didn't come back to the West until brought back by Christopher Columbus and his merry men. There was no gonorrhea. It was called the clap, and it was about another 150 years until it was brought into Europe by crusaders. There was leprosy, which could be sexually transmitted, but there weren't a lot of people lining up to you-know-what with a leper. So the sex was not... I mean, we can... I remember the 60s. Yes, I must actually remember, that's right. Sex was much less fraught with fear than it became later, when it became really deadly. And so the child was illegitimate, it was illegitimate. It was such a common thing that it wasn't a great drama. They also, another reason for good health was they had no sugar. Yes. They had no sugar and they had a great deal of exercise. Either if they're rich enough, they're riding, which takes agility and strength, or they're walking. And they all ate organic food. A whole lot of the greens. Hard to believe, right?
I heard you on the radio, I might be misquoting you, but did you say that Winston Churchill was a descendant of Henry II, and that he thought he was the best king, greatest king of England, because he had introduced the rule of law? And I just wondered, was it something very original to pick up the rule of law, or were other kings around the place having that idea too?
It was about Churchill's attitude to Henry II and whether he introduced the rule of law, that is Henry II.
What Churchill said was, no king has left a deeper imprint on England's laws and traditions than Henry II. He said that in the History of the British People. And he is noted as a descendant of Henry, but I'm sure that's not why he said it. I think he seriously believed it. As to whether it appears to have been original. He didn't sort of pluck it out of the air. It was something that grew as all of these great reforms that grow gradually. he went along with his real fury with the church. 1/6 of his citizen, of his subjects, I mean citizen, of his subjects, claimed benefit of clergy. So they would literally get away with murder. And they'd get a bit of a slap on the wrist from the church. If they were very bad, they were defrocked. But otherwise, things just went on. And he found this offensive. He had a personal strong sense of justice. My guess is because of the injustice done to his mother, and growing up with that. So as far as I know, it was original to him. It certainly hadn't come over from Germany. And at the same time, he introduced what they called a jury system of 12 men. And of course, it was only in the 20th century that women were allowed to be on juries. And this jury system was really a witness system. So instead of pushing somebody underwater and seeing if they drowned, in which case they are innocent, and of course if they floated, well then you could punish them properly. He gathered together 12 men who knew the accused and had a view of the accused behaviour and personality, and if that person would commit this crime or not. So we call those witnesses, but he called it a jury.
Question,
My question also relates to the rule of law.
how did Henry reconcile that with what his mother was basically teaching him, and that he had the right to rule with the Weimar?
How did Henry reconcile the rule of law with what his mother was teaching him about the right of kings?
Well, they're two different things. There wasn't a divine right of kings for in England. The divine right of kings had really, as a concept, had died out. Also in France, it had died out. But there was a feudal system, and so people couldn't be punished at the whim of the king or a baron or so forth. It had to be done according to certain rules. But what we see today in the non-democracies is people punished at the whim of the president or whatever he's called, usually.
Question there, yeah.
I'm just wondering if to any extent you're inspired by Hilary Mantel's book Hall.
Have you been inspired by Hilary Mantel's book?
Well, not to write this, but I find her an absolutely wonderful writer, and she's done a great deal for historical fiction, because she has, as Raymond Chandler did for crime fiction, he brought it up to a respectable level where it had always been disrespected. Hilary Mantel has done the same thing for historical fiction, which was considered to be a branch of chick lit before.
Your historical romance. Yeah.
But Georgette Heyer was into that years ago, wasn't she?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, these things come and go. Yeah. People forget.
Yes.
Hi. Blanche, what do you think of Manning Clark as a historian?
Of the 12th century?
Manning Clark as a historian, did he write about the Crusades or anything?
No, I wasn't aware of it. No. I did. Funny story his publisher, Peter Ryan, told me was that Manning wrote of... what was that terrible bush ranger?
Oh, Ned Kelly.
Kelly was bald like a bullock. Peter Ryan rang him up and said, Manning, bullocks don't have balls.
Well, compared to Hilary Mantel, Antonia Fraser with her latest book, Reform Bill of 1832. How do you rate her?
Especially about Antonia Fraser.
Yes. Well, I think she's a wonderful writer. I haven't read that book. The difference that between me and all of these other people who've been mentioned is that I'm so much further back. Mm. Everybody's familiar with I'm not backward at all. I'm extremely forward. So I'm in a period which is much less known. People can't read about it they can't read the original sources in other than Latin. So whereas once you get to the Tudors, you've got miles and miles of material. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Blanche. Fascinating. My question is, you know, when I was at school, history, and I didn't see eye to eye, now I'm fascinated by it. How do you get a book like this into schools and get the children and you know, teenage kids reading about it and getting interested in it? Because now it's fascinating to me, and I wish I had this sort of thing when I was going to school.
Yes, well...
And what do you do about it? How do you manage to...
Tell them there's sex in it.
No, then it might be banned. We're also politically correct, and some of my sex is not very politically correct. It gets less so in the next book. I would love it. I would absolutely love that. When I was at school, my father said to me, and we obeyed our fathers in those days, you're not to do history at all. You're to do chemistry. He said, you'll pick up history through reading. So I was very bad at chemistry and knew no history and left school completely ignorant. So that is maybe why I've developed a love for it. But yes, indeed, I do hope this is picked up and sent as a text for the HSC. Why don't you start a campaign?
Well, I'd be happy to.
By year 12, they can manage it.
Yes, they know more about it than we do.
Yes.
You mentioned Eleanor was a great patron of the arts, but wasn't she rather more than that? Wasn't she responsible for that genre of courtly love?
Eleanor was responsible for the genre of courtly love.
Yes, I was referring to. The troubadours. The troubadours began in her province, in Aquitaine, and gradually spread upwards through France. And it was with them, and not Eleanor herself, but with them, that the concept of courtly love began. It degenerated in later centuries. It became overly elaborate. But the idea of worshipping women, the Magdalene and the Virgin, and then other women, that sort of was I never pronounced this right, zeitgeist at this time. And she was certainly part of this movement and an encourager of it. And both her father and her grandfather were very considerable troubadours. You can still get them. I found in the University of Western Australia a book of her grandfather's troubadour poetry.
Going back a generation of historians, I remember Barbara Tuchman's book on the 13th century.
Yes, which was absolutely
fascinating.
Yes.
Which is a bit beyond where you've written, but
yes,
before the Tudors. I don't know how much background original sources she was able to go back to.
Question about
that time.
Barbara Tuchman's book on the 13th century.
Yes, I actually thought it was the 14th, but you're probably right. It was. I remember reading it as a teenager, I don't know the answer to that because she was not an academic historian. She was, as far as I know, she was a writer, but a very, very good researcher.
Mm.
And of course, there was another great around that same time, a bit earlier, Mary Renault's books.
Yes.
On the king must die and on ancient Greece. Mm.
Just as a final question, is this now your? I mean, you've got another three volumes to go, but have you now put aside political biography, or is that just something that's happened temporarily while you focus on your historical novels?
I've put aside everything. I'm only doing this, and I think when I get to the...
Yes, it's a big task.
It's a big task, Gareth. Yeah, I think when I get to the end of it, I might, I don't know...
Relax,
yes. Go and lie down somewhere. Nice.
Sell the place in Provence.
Yes.
Anne.
Blanche, it's been a delight. The book is a tremendously wonderful read. I'm just waiting for the next one. Can't recommend it too highly, but tonight you've taken us behind the scenes, you've made it even more interesting, and I wish you well with the next one and the two after that, and come back when you do. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.